Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
He is on X at C Fowler BCM. We have a podcast, On the Bluff, releases every single Tuesday at noon. You can go watch it now, full-length video version on YouTube. It's on Spotify. It's on Apple. Go check that out. But, Christian, what's happening, man? How are you?
Doing wonderful, Gabe. How are you doing?
I am doing well. I was just talking with Connor, though, and we've been talking about the national championship and the Final Four and how, on the men's side, it really was it left a lot to be desired, to be honest with you. Although UConn is at the top of the mountain again, which most of us thought was going to be the case. But none of those games were overly competitive. I think Alabama versus UConn was there, but they ended up, you know, taking off and winning by 14 by the end of that game.
Yeah, that was kind of the common theme with UConn over the last three rounds, though. Like, it was a close game with Purdue, albeit not extremely exciting, and then early in the second half they pull away. Same thing with Alabama, kind of down the stretch, 8 to 10 minutes left, they pull away. In the Illinois game, it was a close game at the half. They end up going on a 30-0 run. So the last three rounds, it really was the same script for UConn. It was at least interesting for half of the game, and then they just ran away with it and made the game not fun to watch anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, obviously for TV and for fan and viewing purposes, it's not the most exciting, but it does show you just how dominant UConn was, and that once the game got later into the second half, midway through the second half, no one really stood a chance.
Yeah, I mean, and they could beat you in any style, any possible way. Last night, what really just jumped off the page, though, they let Edey get whatever he wanted for the most part. Although I think in the second half, using Samson Johnson, who came in and gave five fouls in 5 minutes, had two lob dunks, sort of changed how Zach Edey was playing. All that sort of bumping and grinding with him seemed to work, even though he had 37 by the end of the game. But their perimeter defense last night was absolutely ridiculous. I think in the end of the day, what was Purdue?
One for seven.
Yeah. If you're going to win a national championship, you're going to have to not get ran off the three-point line that badly. They had no chance, and you could tell very early that if they weren't going to be able to put up threes, it was going to be a long night.
Yeah, and when you look at it overall, UConn really did the same thing to Alabama. They ran them off the three-point line. And between Purdue, Alabama, and Illinois, that's three of the better offensive teams in the country this year. Purdue and Alabama, specifically two of the better three-point shooting teams in the country, and then Illinois, just overall, one of the better offensive teams. So regardless of the attack between those teams, whether it's, you know, Terrence Shannon and Illinois style, or whether it's kind of the breakneck speed of Alabama and just getting up a ton of shots, and really it's honestly a lot of the same for Purdue outside of Zach Edey. They want to shoot a lot of threes. I think I read something that they had shot 10-plus threes in every single game over their last, like, 15 or 20 games, and they only shot seven last night and only made one. And they really, what they did is they kind of, as you said, they let Zach Edey get what he wants, and they didn't let anybody else do anything. No one else had a chance to beat them. 37 of the 60 come from Zach Edey. Nobody else is of any effect at all. I think they had, what, four players actually score? Four or five players, and nobody else scored over 7 points. That's pretty incredible what this team is able to do, both offensively and defensively, just how multiple and versatile they are. Stephon Castle can beat you. Tristan Newton can beat you. Donovan Klingon can beat you. Multiple other options that they have. And then defensively, they can pretty much stop you and scheme up whatever way they want to. And really, they did the same thing Fairleigh Dickinson did to Purdue last year. You go back and look at that game, that's exactly what Fairleigh Dickinson did to beat Purdue. They let Zach Edey get what he wanted, and they did not allow them to shoot from the perimeter. UConn did the same thing, and now they're back-to-back national champions.
No, but I'll say this about Fairleigh Dickinson and that Purdue team they were playing last year. They didn't shoot as well. They were not near as good from the three-point line.
That's true.
But this was a 40%, I think, number two in the nation with three-point percentage, and they did that to them. It was just phenomenal. And now I look at UConn, and it's funny, you know, as much as they have won 6 national titles, since 1999. I still don't think, like, every year we've put them in the Duke, Kentucky, North Carolina conversation, but now they're more than a proven commodity as a basketball school. And honestly, it feels like they've passed those names in a lot of ways, right? But it doesn't feel like we really put them in that conversation. You know, Dan Hurley said for the last 25 to 30 years, UConn has been running college basketball. That's the truth. They're 17-1 in national championship games when you combine since 1999 when you combine the women's team and the men's team. They're ridiculous. I feel like, you know, they're obviously a blue blood, but we don't really give them the same respect as some of the other blue bloods.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that as well, and it really doesn't make much sense. And I don't know, you can give me your opinion on this too, but what is the reason they're overshadowed, the men's program? Is it because the women's program was so dominant that, you know, the men's program was successful but not to that level? Is it the fact that the other teams that we're talking about, the Duke, Kentucky's of the world, most of them remain pretty consistent?
Yeah, and they had, well, and UConn maybe had those moments after Kevin Ollie and the beginning of Dan Hurley where it was kind of ugly. It wasn't great.
Right. And is that the reason? Because it just wasn't consistent. I don't even want to say dominance, but just consistent powerhouse and being in Elite Eights and Final Fours and Sweet 16s. Is it because they had a few down years where they weren't really super competitive? And it felt like, okay, that was the, you know, the UConn of old. And it kind of felt like maybe for a minute that the Kimba Walker, Shabazz Napier era, that was the last great era of UConn, and they had the down years. But now it's like, all right, we can't say that anymore. They've won back-to-back national championships, first team since 06-07 Florida under Billy Donovan. That's extremely impressive what Danny Hurley's been able to do.
We got to be honest. This is the most dominant two-year run since John Wooden UCLA, right? That was, what, 67-69. I mean, this is the most dominant two-year run in college basketball, just about college basketball history. And obviously when John Wooden was doing it, it was a different sport. UCLA ran it and won, what, 7 straight titles at one point. So it was there was not a lot of parity. There's more parity in this game. It's harder to do what they have captured the last 2 years. It's way harder than it has been in the past.
Yeah, and I think the only thing that holds it back from being seen more dominant is the 11-8 stretch that they went on in the middle of last year.
Right.
Because if you look at UConn in the beginning of last season, they were killing everybody. And then you look at the tournament, they ran through everybody in the tournament, and no one really played them close in the tournament at all last year. So outside of that 11-8 stretch that they had in the middle of the season, this team really has been nearly flawless. Yeah. It was the same thing in this tournament. No one stood a chance. You mentioned last week, you could bet UConn versus the field, and UConn was almost a -200 favorite over everybody else, and that's how dominant they were and how they were viewed by betting sites as well. So absolutely, I think that one stretch in the middle of last year will keep some people from saying and really looking at it objectively how dominant this team was. But you look at everything outside of that, I mean, they were ridiculous, and they did it with almost two completely different teams, different styles and different ways. And that's extremely impressive to be able to take the team from last year. You lose your top three players from that team. And then in this year, Donovan Clingan, Stephon Castle, and Tristan Newton are your new three top players, and you win it with them. And so it wasn't even the same team, which makes it all the more impressive, the job that Danny Hurley and his staff did.
They lost 5 of their top 8 scorers and 3 guys to the pros, and they got better. It's just exactly. it makes no real sense. And you know that out of conference thing you're talking about, they're like in the Big East, they definitely had their struggles. Like, I completely understand that, and they have lost games in the Big East, especially last year. This year not as much. Besides that Creighton game where Creighton shot what 55% from 3, they didn't have a crazy amount of struggle. But they're 33-1 the last 2 years in out of conference games. That's ridiculous. And that includes the NCAA tournament. That's just absolutely insane. The only game they lost was to Kansas, I believe, too. I mean, I can't get over how dominant these last 2 years have been. Now, let's move on. I want to talk about sort of what the what eclipsed, what sort of was a little bit of a distraction from the national championship game yesterday, and we finally have official news that it is it's going official. Cal to Arkansas. How do you feel about Cal leaving Kentucky after 15 years and heading to Fayetteville? That is that's something.
Yeah, it's not one that I don't think anybody saw this coming, but it is interesting, especially when you look at Cal's quotes after losing to Oakland this year in the first round, being the 3 seed, arguably the best team he had had in years, and the team that had the most chance to make a deep run in the NCAA tournament, losing in the first round to Oakland. The comments he made seemed obviously very frustrated, which we know in those kind of situations Cal can be. But I didn't see him leaving. And if you would have told me that he was done coaching at Kentucky, I probably would have just said he's done coaching overall. But to go to Arkansas, when you really start to peel back the layers, I think it makes sense for both the University of Arkansas and Coach Cal. Obviously, the expectations are different, albeit still high at Arkansas. They're not nearly the same as they are at Kentucky. So the stress is going to be less for him. Clamoring from the fans is going to be less for him. And also, according to reports, he'll get, you know, somewhere between $5 and $6 million a year in NIL money, which is going to be great for him to be able to build the program there, making just a shade less at $8 million a year himself. I believe 5 year, $40 million. Is that the deal? Is that done? Is that official?
Yeah, I think that's what it's going to be. They're going to have, I mean, that getting him to jump from Kentucky, they were going to have to pay him $8 million some odd a year because he's getting $8.5 million at Kentucky.
So I think overall you'll have people that look at this and go, why would he leave? That's a downward move to go from Kentucky to Arkansas. And historically, yeah, it is. But Arkansas still has been a pretty good basketball program. You know, last time they won a championship in 94, but they've had some good runs over the last several years. And I think the biggest thing is the less stress. There won't be as much stress on him. And if he's able to go to an Elite Eight at Arkansas versus Kentucky, it means a lot more at Arkansas than Kentucky. Because at Kentucky, if you make it to the Elite Eight, you're expected to win a championship. At Arkansas, an Elite Eight is good enough.
Yeah, well, I'll say this, though. I think there's a misnomer about, like, pressure, because with $8 million a year and $5 to $6 million a year in NIL, Arkansas fans are going to want results. And if you lose as a 3 seed or a 2 seed to St. Peter's or to Oakland, I mean, you're still gonna feel the pressure from Arkansas fans, although I think they're over the moon in the fact that you lose Eric Musselman. You were really trying to get Chris Beard. That didn't work out. You were trying to get Jerome Tang. That didn't work out. And you'd sort of fall upward into John Calipari. I mean, that works out for them. But he still has to produce. This isn't going to be a situation where Arkansas fans are just going to let him roll and let him roam and let him run everything if they're not getting the results that they want.
No, if they're not making tournaments or if they're first-round bouncing tournaments, of course they're not going to be happy with that, because the expectations for Cal himself, even if the expectations aren't necessarily that for the University of Arkansas, they are when Calipari is the coach of the University of Arkansas, because that's what he's expected to do. So, no, I still think there's a ton of pressure because he's making this move. He's being paid very well. He's kind of been given the keys to go build the program back up. So the pressure is huge, but it's just not the same. It's just not the same level at Kentucky. There's a different level of pressure and of expectations at the University of Kentucky basketball program than there are with the University of Arkansas, regardless of who's the coach at either program.
Now, I will say this. I think that the hope for Arkansas fans is that he tries to lean into the transfer portal a little bit more than he did at the waning years at Kentucky, because we saw that the young guys, he's always got the excuse halfway through the year, oh, we're still trying to grow. I think Arkansas fans are going to want to see him utilize the transfer portal, which he's capable of. He just doesn't seem to want to do at the same level as other coaches.
Yeah, I think it's necessary for him. And I think in this day and age that we're currently in, it's hard to go and win meaningful games in March with a lot of freshmen. Four or five years ago, whatever, it wasn't difficult because your top teams in the country were primarily made up of younger players and freshmen. That's not really the case anymore. Look at Purdue and UConn, the two teams that played in the national championship. Those were not big freshman-driven teams. I mean, Stephon Castle is really the one example that you can give. And outside of that, it's a lot of experienced guys, transfers, players that have been there for X amount of years. And I think for really almost any program at this point to have success, you have to have a good mixture, if not a heavier percentage of experienced veteran players to go do what you ultimately want to do. It brings up questions for kind of like what Duke is doing right now. They're still one of the only teams that are truly building out of the high school ranks. You look at them right now, I think they have four players in the top 20, and we'll see. But is that really the model to success anymore? And I think at least over the last several years, it's been proven that being a primarily freshman team is just not going to be successful, as in terms of maybe Final Four, national championship nowadays, because these teams do have so much experience on their rosters.
All right, now talking with Christian Fowler, senior writer and content creator at Bluff City Media on X at C Fowler BCM. Let's get into Tiger basketball. We need to see what they do in the transfer portal as far as bringing in experience. They got PJ Haggerty and they got Dane Danger. I'll start right there. What do you think about those two moves in particular? I think we talked about it on the podcast. Different feelings about each. Feel great about PJ Haggerty. Definitely going to be some skepticism, some questions about Dane Danger and his actual fit with this team.
Yeah, you look at PJ Haggerty and what he brings, nearly a 22 point per game score, a good rebounder for his size, I think around 5.5 a game, assist around 4.5 a game. And that's with him being by far the most talented player on his team. So I think with him at Memphis, you'll probably see maybe that scoring number go down a little bit, depending on who they bring in, and that assist number maybe go up a little bit. But overall, we love his game, big fans of his game, what he does on both ends of the floor. I think he's versatile offensively. I think defensively he's very active and still has room to grow there. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I just think he still has a high ceiling as a defensive player that maybe hasn't been tapped yet, and I think will be fully tapped if he spends a couple of years at Memphis under Penny Hardaway with his defensive style. And then with Dane Danger, it's a little bit of a different feeling, you know, listed at 6'9", 270, not really someone who's known for getting up and down the floor. He saw his minutes cut in half this year at Illinois, as with Terrence Shannon, they went a little bit faster this year. He went from a 20-minute per game player to a 10-minute per game player, and with that being said, stats went down for him. But he's talked about, you know, potentially dropping weight and trying to be someone who can get up and down the floor more easily, and we'll kind of just have to wait and see on that, because the fit on paper isn't necessarily the best. But if he does transform a little bit, or if this staff has a different kind of plan for him to come in and maybe he plays 10 to 12 minutes a game and more sets rather than a more freestyle flowing offense, all right, we'll see. We'll see exactly how that works. Regardless, though, I think it is a good addition. I don't know if it moves the needle too much at this point. I think if, you know, Memphis ultimately goes out and gets 6 to 8 transfers and Dane Danger is your 4th, 5th, or 6th best transfer, then I think you did a really good job. Yeah, if he's your second best transfer at the end of the day, then you probably don't feel that great about it. But we know they're still in on a lot of other targets, and building this front court, I think we all want to see it be a priority for them. So if he is your 3rd or 4th big, I think it's something that you feel really good about, but I don't think he necessarily moves the needle a ton for this team. But it will be interesting to see how he fits and, you know, what his minutes per game are. And, if he does knock off some weight and is able to get up and down the floor a little bit quicker, what that looks like for this team. So I'm excited about both of them, but I just have a little bit more pause about Dane Danger because of the fit.
Yeah, and I think after last year, seeing Jordan Brown, seeing some of the guys they brought in that looked, you know, shiny, these shiny, good stats, you know, you we're going to have more skepticism and pause heading into next year to see how it all fits together and how all these guys mesh. But we'll see what it looks like. Now, who else is out there that you're looking at that the Tigers could capitalize on? More wish list guys. Is there any more wish list? Because it feels like with Penny and the staff, they're being a little more quiet than they have in the past about who's, you know, taking visits. PJ Haggerty took a visit we didn't even know about. The only guy we know that was on campus that's been reported by the media was Dane Danger, but apparently PJ Haggerty was here as well, and ultimately he committed. But are there any other guys out there that you're looking at as, okay, they're pursuing these guys, they'd be great fits for this team?
Yeah, one that I really like right now is one that they're pursuing, and Aaron Scott out of North Texas, and maybe this isn't the biggest attention grabber, maybe this isn't the biggest name, but just as far as fit, versatility, 6'7" wing, averaged 11 points per game last year, super athletic, versatile, good on both ends of the floor, averages over a steal and a block per game, so just active on that end of the floor. He's someone that I really like. We know that Penny likes long, athletic wings that can get up and down the floor and play on both sides of the ball, and I think that Aaron Scott really fits that mold. So with him being a specific name, and then you kind of just get into players that fit that mold. You want to see Penny and the staff get, you know, a wing that's able to get up and down the floor, doesn't necessarily need a ton of touches a game, can impact the game defensively, whether it's, you know, blocking shots or getting in the passing lanes and creating extra possessions for the offense. And Aaron Scott's the one to me that really, really fills that mold right now. And then also just finding a center, finding a true center for this team.
They're going to have to add some bigs.
Yes, they're going to have to add bigs, but one that fits the system, one that can move, one that doesn't have an issue moving the floor, getting up and down. And you're going to hear me say this over and over because it is the most important thing for a player that's being recruited to come to the University of Memphis. They got to be able to move. They got to be able to get up and down the floor. That's become more prominent, I think, in what we're going to talk about this offseason with Jordan Brown and the lack of fit that he had in this system. So that has to be one of the top priorities. They have to be someone that cares about defense. They have to be someone that can get up and down the floor. So at the wing and at the center position, I think those are two positions that the staff has to hit heavily, and Aaron Scott's a guy that I really like at that wing position.
All right, now final thing, and we'll be real quick on this. It's official. Spence Nowinski, the defensive coordinator from Ohio, has come over as the defensive line coach and assistant defense coordinator. Not co-defense coordinator, assistant defensive coordinator with Jordan Hankins. This was, you know, with Lou Esposito out, you had questions like, oh my gosh, are they going to find anybody who can sort of live up to Lou Esposito's name? Because he's a guy who had been at Memphis before, played here, good defense coordinator in the MAC. Spence Nowinski led the best group of five defense a year ago. This is a very impressive hire on a short turnaround for this staff.
Yeah, I think we were all a little bit disappointed once Lou Esposito left, but it's obviously understandable with him going to Michigan. And now you bring in Spence coming over from Ohio, as you mentioned, and could you really find someone any better to fill that spot at this point, especially after losing someone that was already in the fold? I don't really think you could, and I think it's really big for Ryan and the staff to find someone to fill that role, especially someone that is as qualified as he is. And I think we continue to see that he is growing not only as a coach, but as someone who is able to identify and find assistant coaches to fill the staff. If nothing else, the loss of Lou Esposito going to Michigan told you pretty much all you needed to know. And now with this addition as well, like, Ryan Silverfield is really doing an impressive job of finding coaches for the staff.
No question about it. Well, Christian, I appreciate it. We'll do it again next Tuesday.
All right, see y'all next week.
Yes, sir. He's Christian Fowler, senior writer and content creator for Bluff City Media. He's on X at CFowlerBCM. Check out our podcast, On the Bluff, releases every Tuesday at noon.